I was interested in talking to you about Lillian Hellman. Of course, I go way back literarily with Lillian Hellman because even in college, I wrote two papers on the plays of Lillian Hellman.
So did you?
I'm quite familiar with...
Which two?
Well, actually, it was one paper that I used in two classes.
I see. Just like the rest of us.
I did Toys in the Attic.
Yeah.
Little Foxes.
And yeah.
What was the third one? This is 1956, you know, and I have one other play, and I lumped them all together. And
right.
And I hesitate to think of what I must have written as post-adolescent at that time.
We all did that.
You go back with Lillian Hellman, too, don't you?
Yeah, I go way back. I met Lillian when I was 10. She was, I think, around 25 years older than I am. I've never been sure because the last thing Lillian said was, I've lied about my age so much I don't know how old I am myself anymore. I would think 25 years. I met her when I was 10 in New Orleans in my parents' house. And we remained friends till she died.
You are both from New Orleans.
Yes. She was of another generation and all like that. But New Orleans is New Orleans, and customs and traditions, and there's a kind of tone to the city that stays with you forever.
In your book, Eating Together, you describe, I believe, that early meeting with Lillian Hellman. Can you recall what it was like and what she did?
I don't much remember what she did. I remember walking downstairs. I remember the look of her back. That stayed with me all my life. She had a way of standing, both very strong and very feminine. And I remember being somewhat self-conscious and shy and abashed. Not because she was a writer, I'd met writers before, but she asked me how old I was, and I said I was only 10, and she said, I don't know what you mean by only 10 isn't so young, and turned her back. I remembered that all my life, and all hers. She was an extraordinarily feminine and graceful and kind of fierce woman. I remember her angers, I remember them from when I was 10 years old, and God knows they lasted all her life.
Now, you're talking 25 years ago, right?
No. I'm 54. I'm not talking 25 years ago.
Considerably.
It was a 43-year friendship.
43-year
yeah.
friendship. Well, were you both... Was she living in New Orleans at this time?
She was not, no. She was in New York. We both moved to New York in adolescence. Mine didn't come for a while. I was 10 then, so I moved when I was 14. I think she moved at about that age.
How did you manage to keep up a relationship with Lillian Hellman over the years?
Well, there were jumps in it. I didn't see her again until I was 18, and then not again until I was 28. From that time until today, from 28 to 54, it was pretty steady. I guess our relationship was kind of what hers with Hammett was. I had, by the time we got to be fast friends again, I'd written two novels and published them. But Lillian kind of took me over in a way, and was the best thing that ever happened to me. I wrote a couple of books on her house and in her house on the vineyard, which is a wonderful house. She's left it to me, so I'll be living there, I guess, now. But we traveled together all over the world, arguing most of the time on the vineyard and elsewhere. Life with Lillian was a long, rather happy argument. It was one of her ways of showing affection, I think.
What did you argue about?
Anything and everything. What's in Eating Together, what's talked about is the arguments about cooking and food, mainly. But we argued about whatever there was to argue about getting up in the morning or whatever occurred. It was Lillian's way of communication, I think, with a great many people, certainly with me.
As you wrote these early novels of yours, did she give you any literary input?
Sure. She was very strong. She not only strong, but the anger showed there, too. She'd had good training. Hammett had thrown the seventh, I think, version of one of her plays in her face one day and claimed he didn't want to know her if she wrote that way. So she had no pity for what one goes through to write. She just figured if you didn't want to go through it, don't write, which is kind of the best gift you can give a writer. She treated everybody like a peer, it's what happened when I was 10. She treated children as peers, age peers, actually. But writers she treated in a curious way. So that eating together is a result, really, of all those years of having at least one person treat me as an equal.
Was she supportive?
Very.
As you wrote it, did she look over the manuscripts that you...
Yes, we used to, in the happy working times, we used to come downstairs from our separate rooms on the vineyard and read to each other, the work that we'd done the day before, or the work in her case that she'd done that morning. She got up around 6, so by the time I came downstairs, she was finished for the day. I would read to her and she to me.
But she had no difficulty in lacing into you if she didn't like what you wrote.
She never had any difficulty. She did that wonderful thing, that best of all things. There are those people who will say to a writer, I wonder if I'd do that quite that way, which somehow is much more cutting than somebody yelling in your face, what in hell do you think you're doing, or worse. There's something about somebody screaming at you or yelling at you that has more love in it, and more concern and more passion in it for you and therefore for your work, or vice versa, than the very well put, selected phrase. Lenin was involved in writing in the deepest sense of the term.
What prompted you and Lillian Hellman to embark upon this very unusual book, which is part cookbook, part memoir?
Eating Together. It was Eating Together did Eating Together, as a matter of actual fact. For something like 20 years, we planned to open a restaurant. I think most writers want to run restaurants. I don't know why that is, but I have yet to run across a writer who didn't at some point want to. And most do when you talk to them, if you bring it up.
Or a bookstore.
One of the two, or both. Lillian and I always wanted to open a small restaurant and make a lot of money and write as we always had, as we wanted to write. But writing at the periphery of oneself, somehow putting the focus on food or on a restaurant, makes life seem easier. I'm sure it isn't, but it makes it seem that way. And about 3 years before she died, she said, look, I'm not going to live to run a restaurant with you. So why don't we do a cookbook, or at least part cookbook? We're not professional cooks, so we can't really do a proper one, but we can do what you cook and what I cook. And we can do it part memoir, what we remember as we went along, what each recipe brings back to mind. It's why Eating Together has the subtitle Recollections and Recipes, because the recollections are tied into the recipes, both in her section and in mine.
Lillian Hellman did not live to see the completion of this project.
No, she lived to hear it, though. I read her the completed manuscript about 3 months before she died, and I was on my way to the vineyard with the galley proofs of the book when she died. She heard it, laughed and chuckled and her way through it. She was legally blind and half paralyzed when she wrote her section of this book. So it was the result of that kind of discipline that results in work, no matter what happens to your body or to you.
She was in frail health, wasn't she, in the last couple of years of her life?
Yeah, in more than the last couple of years. But it never affected her writing ability. It never affected her thinking in the long term, in the long range sense. She forced herself to do it, and I think it had so long been the structure of her life that to give it up, particularly for a woman as independent as Lillian, a woman who had run a farm and written her four most successful plays at the same time, for her to be so incapacitated that she couldn't light a cigarette or answer the phone or go to the bathroom without physical assistance, to have your independence wrenched away from you in that way is, I think, unthinkable, unless you can in some way at least go on with what your life meant. And she went on in this book, in Eating Together, she went on writing.
Was she that badly incapacitated when she wrote her last book, the one actually prior to Eating Together, Maybe?
No, she was on her way to it. It was a gradual process. The first stroke is described in this book, in Eating Together. I don't think she was aware until maybe the year before she died that it had been her first stroke. She thought it, she attributed it to numbers of other things. She was in, it was in France that she fell down one day. But she never connected it. I did. I mentioned it to her. And she said she didn't think so. She said that Robert Lowell had said the same thing. And then years later, she said, I think you were probably right, that was it. But from then on, it was a gradual decline.
Tell me about the day of her death. You called her, I suppose.
I called her to say I would be late with the proofs of the book by about 10 days, because some muck-up in the publishers. And she said, you can't be late. And I said, it's just a few days, Lily. She said, you don't understand. I want to work. I want to work. I want to work. She said it three times. It's the last thing I remember her saying. She died about 6 hours later.
Are you the heir, her heir?
I'm one of them, yes. She left me a number of things. I never expected it. It was very, very nice and very strange. She left me the means with which to go on for the rest of my life writing what I want to write. I had been doing movie scripts or helping to fix them in between novels, and I no longer have to do that. She left me the house and on the vineyard that we'd been so happy in together, and she left me an income.
Well, Peter Fiebelman, I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, you sure are.
I hope that, I'm glad that you came in to give me some insights about Lillian Hillman, your relationship with her, how Eating Together came about, and I hope that I'll be able to have you come back and we'll talk more directly and distinctly about your own work and what got you started and what you're doing.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I hope so, too.
It was the Children's Hour.
Right.
The
sure. Sure. It would make sense.
I have most of her recent books, maybe. And,
do you?
Unfinished Woman. And, I thought they were very, very good books. And I've been amused about the controversy over how much of her memoir was fiction and how much of it was fact. I've talked to a lot of people who write memoirs. Have you read Romantic Education by Patricia Campbell?
Sure.
There's an example of a book that has a lot of imagination in it.
I think a great many memoirs do. I think Out of Africa does, you know. And, when they sat down to do a movie out of that book, they discovered that the Baroness Blixen's sex life was not necessarily as romantic as she had given us to believe. I think everybody does that a little bit, or a lot of people do that.
Herbert Gold, when he wrote Fathers,
mm-hmm.
did that?
Good book.
Originally, I see it's been reprinted, and it's called a memoir. But when it first came out in 1966, I happened to compare the copy because I had Herbert in
yeah.
a couple of weeks ago. And it was described as a novel when it first came out. But he used his real names of his father, and
yeah.
he used real dates, and he described it as a novel.
Yeah.
But I noticed the new version calls it a memoir. So there's it's something in between.
It's back and forth. Of course it's in between. It's why Lily used the term pentimento, I think, was that she knew herself that she couldn't get back exactly to actual statistical fact. You get as close as you can.
Well, the very fact that dialogue is included,
of course,
is indicative of it. You can reconstruct dialogue, but
you can't remember it verbatim unless you wrote it down, or unless you, in those days, you wouldn't have taped it. Yeah,
reconstructed dialogue is always better than the real thing.
I think so, and certainly in the hands of somebody like Lillian, who thought in dialogue.
Are you living in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I'm in the process of moving out here. I have been living there for a very long time.
You'll be living in New York in Martha's Vineyard?
I think so, yeah. If I can take the cold. I'm a southern fella. If I can manage.
Well, it's not too bad. It's true. There are a couple of months it gets chilly. But, I know New Orleans, and I've been there quite a few times. And, in fact, my family, they live in Houston, Texas, and the climate in Houston is not much different
no, it
than
isn't.
That in New Orleans. I assure you, you'll be much more comfortable here.
I will?
Oh, you can't even breathe in New Orleans and Houston. I go down there, and I grew up there in the 40s when there was no air conditioning in
yeah.
Houston.
Yeah.
All the houses had screened-in porches. And
I remember very well.
To sit on a screened-in porch, or even my brother lives down there. He has a patio.
Yeah.
And he likes to cook out, but they can't use the patio. until the winter comes.
It's yeah, sure, hot. Of course.
And even in the winter, it's so humid that sometimes it gets very chilly and clammy.
I know. I remember that. There's still something about the extremes of cold here that get to me. I don't know what it is. Maybe the time in Los Angeles where there's no weather, you know, of any kind known to man. It just is sunny all the time and rains once a year about, and that's it. But I don't know if I can manage it. I know that today really got to me.
Yeah, we've had a cold snap. How's it on Martha's Vineyard in the winter?
Less than this. Yeah. Islands are, because they, you know.
They tell me we go to Nantucket frequently in the summer, and they now I understand there are a couple of places on Nantucket that are open year-round, and they say it's quite pleasant.
Nantucket?
Never snows.
No, it doesn't. I spent a year on Nantucket when I was a kid and liked it a lot. I like it better, actually, than the Vineyard, except I know more people on the Vineyard. But as an island, I like Nantucket better.
Oh, yes, there's no question that Nantucket is more quaint and more beautiful.
And more islandy.
And more islandy, but Martha's Vineyard has a much more of a social life.
Oh, God, it's, yeah. It has more of one in New York, I think, in the summer, anyway. Not in the winter. But.
Well, listen, I thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
And talking to me.